Okay, the 2 o'clock session of the City Council will come to order. Oh, there he is. Okay. Never mind.
Did you gavel us to order?
I was just starting that.
So okay. Go ahead. Good evening, everybody, or good evening, good afternoon, everybody. Today is Wednesday, July 21st, 2010. It is 2 o'clock. City Council is in afternoon session. Coming back from recess, Carly, can you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish? Adams?
Here. Can you please read the time certain? A report, item number 1076.
Accept report on human trafficking.
Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you all for being here today. As you may recall, in earlier this month, in July, both Multnomah County Board of Commissioners and the City of Portland City Council have proclaimed July 2010 as Human Trafficking Awareness Month. So today we're here to learn not just about the problem of human sex trafficking, but to hear what community partners are doing as far as local coordinated response. I'm sure, like most of you, this whole epidemic of human sex trafficking is shocking to me. I'm shocked how young victims are, with the average age of entry into prostitution being age 13. I'm shocked how pimps utilize a whole network of our streets, our shopping malls, our parks, our schools, and the internet to find and exploit their victims. And I'm also shocked how human trafficking has mushroomed in front of us to the point that Portland is known as the trafficking hub, and Dan Rather taped a segment recently calling City of Portland Pornland, Oregon. And I know that it's just not shocking, not just to me, but I know it's shocking to our whole community. And there's certainly been a rising of interest to the challenge of human sex trafficking in our community. While a lot of today's information will be about youth victims, I do want to remind everyone that these girls grow into women, and some of the same women who are walking along 82nd Avenue. So we need responses not only for those who are under 18, but also for women who are over 18. So rather than lament about the problem and the helplessness to the brazenness of the pimps and the Johns, the speakers today will talk about how we are working to combat trafficking and how various agencies and organizations are coming together as part of a local action plan. As big as this crisis is, we are resolute in stopping the exploitation of our communities, girls and women. We're already making headway with some first steps. I'm very excited about a pilot program that LifeWorks Northwest and JOIN are beginning in the next couple of months to house 4 to 6 adult women. JOIN will bring housing placement services and rent assistance, and LifeWorks will leverage that with program resources. I want to thank Portland Housing Bureau and Commissioner Nick Fish for their work in this regard. And I'm also very excited to announce that the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services we'll have a new tenant, which is the Sexual Assault Resource Center. And I believe they will be dedicating 2 advocates who will work with victims at the new Gateway Center, which is opening on September 9th, to work with victims who are being trafficked as well as maybe subject to domestic violence. And so with that, I'd like to begin with our first panel of invited speakers. And we're very lucky to have 2 very dedicated Multnomah County commissioners, Commissioner Diane McKeel and Commissioner Barbara Willer, and also our U.S. Attorney General for the District of Oregon, Dwight Holton. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Commissioner Barbara Willer from Multnomah County, and I want to thank you for taking your time this afternoon to learn about this important issue, and thank you particularly, Commissioner Saltzman, for your leadership on this issue and working closely with us. Until 2009, this is a relatively new issue for me. It wasn't until I went to a presentation at Providence Hospital that was organized by a coalition of women religious congregations that I even was aware of this. I did not know this was happening in the Northwest or in Portland. And it saddened me, it angered me, and finally it moved me to take some action. I want to recognize the leadership of Commissioner McKeel in the county for moving this forward, for working hard with our state leaders, and for you. She has really championed this in the county, and when I came back to the county, I was really happy to partner with her and work with her leadership on this. As Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, we collectively passed, both the city and the county, these resolutions to create a month of awareness. And as part of that, I helped organize on July 10th a public witness in our park blocks. And it was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. The weather was perfect, and about 300 people gathered to take witness against this. And it was organized by the Sisters of Holy Names. I'm a member of that community. And we had local officials, including Dwight and Commissioner McKeel and Commissioner Saltzman, Senator Wyden, as well as 20 other community organizations. And I speak about this because I think there is a breadth of diversity here within our community that wants to step forward, is stepping forward to work on this. So I want to thank you for your leadership, and I'm glad to be here supporting the work here, and I look forward to continuing our relationship. Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner McKeel?
Thank you. And thank you for having us here today and for the collaborative work that we're all doing around this issue. The problem of human trafficking is one that is rarely in the headlines and it's mostly misunderstood in the United States. While many people understand that modern-day slavery still exists in countries abroad, few realize that it is occurring right here in the USA, including Portland and Multnomah County. The average age of entry for victims of sex trafficking is 12 to 14 years old. They are our neighbors, they are our friends, and they are our families. Because of our location along the I-5 and I-84 corridors, Oregon and Portland have become prime grounds for these terrible acts. Pimps and thugs hang out at our malls and our schools waiting for girls they can approach. Once the girls have been coerced into working the streets, pimps use violence, fear, and drugs to prevent them from escaping. While this issue is underreported and largely unrecognized among the public, there is much being done by local police, the district attorney, and our federal and local leaders to change that. There are movements to increase awareness, treat those who are being victimized, and punish those who are forcing others to engage in commercial sex. Last summer, I met with Senator Ron Wyden's office, and he has instantly become one of the greatest advocates for the elimination of sex trafficking in our region and in the nation. He has introduced Senate Bill 2925, which would provide block grants across the nation to local governments for arrest and prosecution of pimps and traffickers, and it would create victim safe houses, complete with mental and physical health services and treatment. If passed, it could be the beginning of the end for trafficking as one of the most low-risk and high-reward crimes in our nation. Furthermore, thanks to the leadership of State Representatives Brent Barton and Jefferson Smith in the Oregon Legislature, state legislation was passed in February that requires a sticker bearing the National Human Trafficking Hotline number to be sent to each OLCC-licensed establishment in Oregon. And I actually brought some of those stickers today, if you'd like to have some here. The stickers include the definition of trafficking and encourage readers to call the hotline if they believe that they or someone they know might be a victim. Once a call is placed, it is routed to a local law enforcement and service providers, who are then able to pursue a case and provide treatment or assistance. When similar stickers were placed in liquor stores in Texas, calls to the hotline increased by 35%. While we are not sure yet of our exact numbers because our stickers have just gone out, We are optimistic this legislation will be met with similar success in our state. Finally, here in Multnomah County, we are working on the establishment of a school designed to reduce the number of those who purchase sex. Basic economics shows that where there is demand, there will be supply. Unfortunately, there is great demand for the purchase of sex in our county. Through use of best practices, the program will require the Johns to fully understand the impacts of their actions on the girls and women they victimize. By educating these predators, the real consequences of their actions, and reducing the likelihood of recidivism for these crimes, we can begin to reduce the demand for commercial sex. As we can see, there is much being done to address the problem of human trafficking in our region, but far more is left to do. By showing that the City of Portland and Multnomah County are willing to make a commitment to end this injustice, we are hoping to be an example to the rest of the United States. With continued work, we can end this practice in our region. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. U.S. Attorney?
Good afternoon. My name is Dwight Holton, and I'm the United States Attorney for Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I am a firm believer that my office must be an agent for positive change in the community. We have tremendous capacity to help make communities safer and stronger, and that's why I've been heavily engaged with Diane and Barbara and with Dan on this issue. I've had the pleasure to work with Nick on some other issues, including Commissioner Fish on other issues, including mortgage fraud, and I look forward to working with the rest of you as well. Slavery is alive and thriving in Portland and in Oregon today, right now. And I'm not talking about some metaphoric slavery or symbolic slavery. I'm talking about human bondage as real and as violent as slavery that we think of it in from our history books. The record of this slavery, of this modern slavery, is written in the case files of the criminals that we prosecute in my office. Criminals who pluck young girls off the streets from places like Seattle, bring them to Oregon, and force them into the sex trade through cajoling, threats, violence, and drug addiction. Guys like Deshaun Milton, who recently pled guilty to bringing four teenage girls here to Oregon and forcing them into the sex trade, and who now faces a 10-year mandatory minimum prison sentence. Guys like Joseph Washington, who took a teenage girl named LW off the streets of Seattle, brought her here, advertised for sex with her online, and is now serving a 10-year prison term. Guys like Donico Johnson, who plucked a 15-year-old girl off the streets of Seattle, brought her here to Oregon to sell her body, and who was recently sentenced to 15 years in prison. We stand at a crossroads. We can, both geographically and as a matter of public policy, geographically, the crossroads makes us a magnet for this kind of slavery. We stand at crossroads as a matter of public policy because the question is, are we going to step up to the plate and end it? We in law enforcement can and will continue to do what we can. We work very closely with my trunk and with the other and with local police, with PPB and other local law enforcement, the sheriff's office and others. But the truth is that law enforcement steps in at the end of this tragedy. We can't fix it. We can only seek punishment and retribution and to prevent further crimes. The solution to this problem is not law enforcement, it's community action. And what is needed, what we need, is community action on two levels. First, support for the victims of human trafficking. And the proposals that county commissioners and Mr. Saltzman have mentioned are critical. Senator Wyden's leadership on this and the block grant proposal is a tremendous opportunity, and he's been a real leader on this. The second area of community action that we need is to stop the viability of the market for prostitution like this. Stop treating prostitution as a victimless crime, to stop the demand. So we stand ready to help in any way we can. We think it's an incredibly important issue, and it's as poignant as they come in my world, and I got a pretty poignant world I work in. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Our next invited panel is going to provide us with a survivor profile and some current survivor services. So I want to invite up Jerry Williams. who is a survivor. We'll talk about her personal experience. Miriam Green with the Oregon Department of Human Services, Child Welfare. And Esther Nelson with the Sexual Assault Resource Center. We'll talk about victim services.
Welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Jerry.
Welcome to our home. I'm Jerry Williams, as you know, and I currently work for the City of Portland Office of Neighborhood Involvement as a program manager for the Diversity and Civic Leadership Project. I'm incredibly excited. I always do get excited about activism and grassroots leadership development that we're seeing here. I was wondering, Commissioner Leonard, do you remember like 2 years ago when we sat on that stage and we talked about that for the first time? We had a meeting with about 400 neighbors as we were looking at Tom Putter was here getting rid of the prostitution free zone and the groundswell of people who were very, very upset about having these women out on the streets. And so after hours, I'm an activist, organizer, artist, writer, mother, grandmother, native Oregonian, and soon-to-be college student. I start at Warner Pacific in August. I'm taking urban studies because I do want to be the best representative I can for my community. I'm also a survivor of human trafficking. After escaping a very violent marriage in Rhode Island, I left there and came home to be near my family back in 1988. Struggling to raise two toddlers by myself in a town where I knew no one, I fell into the wrong crowd of folks in 1989 and got pimped out to 82nd Avenue. Through that, I got jumped into a gang by being raped by several of its members. Almost every night in the summer of 1989, I was forced to walk 82nd Avenue, put my life in danger, and sell my body to strangers. All of the money went to the pimp. I used drugs to cope with the issue of doing something I never imagined that would happen to me. I got out after being stabbed by a trick and being left for dead in Southeast Portland. I got to where I am today because there were services there that were able to help me deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder, the shame, and all of the other issues that I had, including alcohol and drug problems at that time. This happened to me when I was in my 20s, and this was 20 years ago. The sad truth about what's happening today in our city is that the average age for girls, as you keep hearing, is 12 to 14. And I think the reason that we keep saying that is because it's so shocking. You think, shouldn't these girls be in school? Shouldn't they be living this young, doing what young girls do? And on one level, they do. They come from wealthy families, middle-class homes, low-income homes. They're persuaded into this tragic life on our public transportation system, in our malls and parks, and there are very, very little services for them currently. But there is hope. In the last 2 years since you and I sat there, there's been a groundswell of community coming up. Faith-based organizations, churches, people who want to volunteer. When we did this briefing at the county, hundreds of county people, after we did the briefing, called in and volunteered. They said, I want to help. Hundreds of county workers called in, and there were 6,000 tweets that afternoon. I know you can respect tweets. And so the community is there, and we will have a and we need to have the political will as well. We do have much of the political will through Senator Ron Wyden pushing so hard to bring those dollars in for our help, through Dan Saltzman and Amanda Fritz. Committed work on this continually and your support for the survivors of this and for Commissioner Leonard as well, who supported me when I first spoke out. Through County Commissioners McKeel and Willer and many other state legislators, we are going to get there. This is an issue that people in Portland care about. As we are currently looking at the discussion of the Portland plan and including voices that haven't been heard before, we need to include these voices as well. What I think when we're looking at the next 30 years of the Portland plan is that we don't want to be known as porn land. We don't want to be known as someone who has a high level of young people being trafficked in our city. That needs to find some way into the Portland plan. And it needs to find some way into the legislative desires we're discussing in August for the city as well. And so we can defeat trafficking in our state and the city of Portland. As I tell folks all the time who come into leadership development programs through the City of Portland, through the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. We need to be the squeaky wheel in this situation. And I have to run, so thank you.
So if you have to run, and I'm sorry to interrupt your presentation, but you brought up a very important subject that I think is a teachable moment for the entire community and some on the council. When we sat on that stage 2 years ago, I know you remember this, but I want to remind everybody, the reason we're on that stage is because the community was angry, and frankly, the police bureau was angry that some of us did not want a continuation of a prostitution-free zone. That's why we were there.
Yes.
And people were very angry. And what we insisted on doing in sense instead over the objections of the police bureau and the objections of the community was to develop the programs that we're talking about here today, to not actually believe that if you have a prostitution-free zone, it'll make somebody quit being a prostitute, when all it really did was put it in somebody else's neighborhood.
That's right.
What we insist on was programs and services for women that were in exactly the position you were, and you were a hero to articulate on that stage at the school that we were at, what you'd been through, to have people realize you can't just move it out of your backyard. It goes to somebody else's backyard. And what we see today, 2 years later, are successful women who have then now been steered into those programs and have found sanctuary and alternative ways of living as a result of that. So I want to, you know, especially since you're leaving, acknowledge you were one of the few that stood up there with me and agreed with that approach. And I'm really proud of you and all you've done.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry.
Miriam?
I just want to lead off with that. I think that if 82nd Avenue was in everybody's backyard and Craigslist was in everybody's backyard, we wouldn't have this issue going on. But I'm Miriam Green. I'm with the Department of Human Services Child Welfare. I manage the Child Abuse Hotline for Multnomah County. So we take abuse reports for Multnomah County after hours. We intentionally take them for Clackamas and Washington counties, and we get them across the state because we're open 24/7 and have a 1-800 number. We also, out of my office, the after-hours response is managed for immediate protective service concerns. So starting to go to trafficking task force meetings, I was a little chagrined to hear about all these children and know that we were not getting reports of sex abuse of children through our office, and it just didn't make sense to me. The hidden in plain sight really caught me. It's like something's going on here. We took a pause in July of 2008 and asked our staff, primarily our staff who work with teenagers that are in DHS custody and some in family care still, were they seeing these youth? Were they working with these youth? And we got back with the names of about 40 children at that point in time who, in 2008, our staff said they had worked with during the past year to 18 months. So we took those 40 names, looked at those children, and tried to make some sense of what we were seeing. What we were seeing was a number of children who had previous sex abuse issues. We saw children who had multiple system involvements. We saw children who had multiple placement failures. We saw children who had multiple police contacts. We saw children who had multiple runs. And a number of these girls were missing more of the year than they were available for school or anything else, or available to us for services or treatment. So we did two things. We continued to try to identify these children for two reasons. One, felt very important to all of us to make sure we were getting these reports as sex abuse reports, because that's what they are. And it also seemed very important to continue to try to look at who these children were so we could look at improving our practice and how we were going to respond. So a little bit about the numbers as we've continued to do our best shot at tracking them. To date, from approximately the summer of 2007 to present, we've identified 105 children that have been victims of trafficking. These are not all Multnomah youth, nor are they the whole state count, but they are children that a report has come through our county to be reported, most often because they've appeared in our county. They are from Clackamas and Washington counties as well, as you would imagine. They're from Polk, they're from Marion, they're from Yamhill, they're from Jackson, they're from Warm Springs, they're from Washington State, both Longview and Clark County. 15 to age 16 is the ages about that we see these kids present, but in talking with them and doing good interviews by ourselves and partners, we're finding out that these children are entering the life, as people are saying, as early as age 12, sometimes younger. And I would anticipate, as we do a better job identifying these children and serving them, that we will start getting reports of younger children, which will be tragic, but it will be a blessing in terms of earlier intervention, as I see it, until we get the whole problem to disappear. The group is disproportionate for African Americans, 31 out of the 105 are African American, 3 are Native American. None are presenting as Hispanic, and I don't know, that's surprising to me. It's, you know, a question more than, again, this is our best shot at the information we can gather. The majority of these children are sex abuse victims. It really appears to add to their vulnerability that makes them just stand out for traffickers. 8 have developmental delays. 12 have a family history of their family, their biological family being in the life. 11 are adopted, 11 out of 105. Of those 11 that are adopted, 5 of them, their birth families were involved in the life prior to those children coming into our care and custody. It really speaks to me about the entrenchment of the lifestyle. Right now, as of yesterday, we have 52 girls currently on open DHS cases. 33 of these youth are in the custody of the state. Clearly, having them in the custody of the state is not by itself a preventative or protective measure in and of itself, or we would not have, that would not be the case. So what are we doing to improve services? We are screening these cases as sex abuse cases, I'm happy to report, which we should be doing in a handful of these cases. The parents are involved in turning their youth out or exploiting them more often. The parent, like you or I would be, is helpless, and I can't even imagine that feeling. And the pimp has total control, so there's access. So we're assigning them because it's a sex abuse case, because there's access of the perpetrator, and because the parent is unable to protect without assistance. We're referring all of these reports for field protective service assessments. We have designated staff that have been through training that are responding. We are cross-reporting directly to the sex crimes unit and doing better collaboration to work toward arrest and prosecution. We're involving SARC upfront and with every case, and thrilled that there's a lifeline for these youth, even if a safe lifeline for these youth, even if we're not able to keep our hands on them consistently. We're connecting to medical partners, mental health partners who understand this particular type of trauma and are willing to step up and try to engage youth in different ways. We're working with our current shelter and residential providers to have their staff trained and to make sure that they can and are willing or hope and provide wraparound services as best we can by those who are informed in working with these youth to better maintain children in placement. It's a drop in the bucket. We still need some a safe place, a safe receiving center with highly trained staff. We need more advocates. We need more mentors who've been through the life, like Jerry. We need an informed continuum of safe housing with treatment options that follow children regardless of what county they're in. We need what you're starting, drop-in groups for children. We need them for parents as well. And we need some different legislation around the youth, possibly deferred disposition as an option for victims. But they certainly can't be prosecuted as youth who are sex abuse victims, in my opinion. We need to continue a community and raise a community model of victim to survivor to leader. And I was really proud to be sitting here with the folks I'm sitting here with, because what we really need to continue to do is to be informed by the people who are survivors. So thank you.
Thank you, Miriam. Esther?
I would second all of that. Hi, my name is Esther Nelson, and I'm a case manager at the Sexual Assault Resource Center, SARC, and we provide support services for sexually exploited youth in Washington County, Multnomah County, and Clackamas County. We also serve youth who are identified here who have come from other counties, so anywhere in Oregon State. We've had them from Washington State, Georgia, Florida. But if they're found here, then we provide services for them. So we have the great privilege of being able to be first responders. So we meet them kind of on the front end of a case. If they're identified by law enforcement or by the hotline, they'll call us out and we'll do emergency response. Within 30 minutes, we'll get to any emergency room in the Tri-County area, any law enforcement precinct, or even out in the field if law enforcement is present. We'll respond right away and we'll provide advocacy, which means support. We'll triage their needs. Do they need mental health services? Do they need Project Respond? Are they looking for a place to stay? So we'll do a triage of needs up front, and then we'll provide case management long-term for them. And that's my job. I also have a counterpart, another worker, Elisa, who does the same job as me. And we're really excited to be moving into the one-stop shop, which I think will be a great geographical location for us. It's very accessible for the youth, I feel. So we do ongoing case management for them and connect them to a myriad of services. They need housing, most of all. They need their basic needs to be met, and they're currently not being met. They need schooling. They need medical attention. They need investigative support, so we'll go with them to ongoing interviews. If they have a detective's interview, if they go to court, we'll go with them to court, and they need a lot of support around court. So meeting with them ahead of time and preparing for them for this experience is maybe very nerve-wracking for them. And then last but not least, we just love to support and celebrate young women. They're amazingly strong, and they have so many resiliency factors going on, and they just need someone, I think, to celebrate that for them. So we are very privileged to be able to do that, and I'm just so excited that this program has grown out of virtually nothing, just a great need, and I'm just excited to be able to do that. So thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you.
What's the hotline number? We probably can't say it too many times.
731-3100.
731-3100.
And in case you're wanting to speak off the record, our hotline number is 503-640-5311.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Our next panel is going to give a law enforcement perspective. We have Lieutenant Mike Marshman from the Portland Police Bureau, who will talk about Portland Police Bureau's role, including Sex Crimes Unit and East Precinct. And then we have Greg Moad, who is the with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and he'll talk about legal tools available and still needed. Welcome.
Thank you. Mike Marshman, Lieutenant in the Detective Division for the Portland Police Bureau. I oversee the human trafficking detail in the Sex Crimes Unit. So in order to keep my comments brief, a lot of great speakers prior to myself took a lot of my talking points, but that's good because I think we're all at least seeing this from the same view and in the same lens. So I'm just going to dive into the nuts and bolts of how law enforcement enters into this problem. First off, at East Precinct, there's a prostitution coordination team, if you will. It's a few officers who go out on the street and try to stem the prostitution problem from a livability view. The ones that the citizens of Portland are seeing on the street. When they run into young girls, they then would page out and call our sex crimes detectives, who then go out and respond with Esther from SARC and other resources to try to help these girls from a victim services standpoint, as well as trying to learn more about the pimp, where they're from, both the pimp and the victim, and see if they're being trafficked or not. If it's a local case, we can handle that pretty much in-house with our resources. But lots of times, the numbers are kind of hard to solidify. These girls are being trafficked mainly in four states that we've run into recently: Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California. When we run across those efforts, we then get our federal partners involved to try to prosecute the pimps federally. We're currently working on a memorandum of understanding with a local FBI office to partner with those folks, because one of the main problems we have is the girls that we're trying to help through SARC and other resources, they frequently run. If they run local, that's one issue to try to find them locally. But if they're running to different states, that's incredibly problematic when Greg and his crew try to prosecute the pimp. So we're trying to get all these entities involved to have one unified front to help the victim first, but then second to hold the pimps accountable. So again, I won't be redundant in what a lot of the other speakers have said. So I'd like to kind of open up to you if you have any questions about some of the nuts and bolts, minutia operation of how law enforcement, at least, is trying to tackle this problem, but collaboratively with victim services, other police agencies, and our federal partners.
Why don't we let Greg testify first, and then if there's questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Greg Mowad, and I'm a deputy district attorney here in Multnomah County. And there has been sort of an approach from law enforcement in terms of dealing with these cases is we've been dealing with the symptoms. We've been dealing with prostitution-free zones. We've been dealing with towing cars. We've been dealing with trying to get street-level prostitution handled. But we haven't ever really begun dealing with the disease, the underlying backbone, which is driving those things that drive the public to call your offices and complain. There's been a sea change here in Portland over the last 5 or 6 years to attempt to address the backbone of the problem a little bit more effectively. And I think that we've begun that process, although that process, frankly, right now is in its infancy. We have taken sort of a step back from the street-level prostitution issues and begun to look at demand, begun to look at physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse of these youth at a time when they're most fragile, and, of course, at their victimization at the hands of pimps. street officers at the Portland Police Bureau are no longer simply arresting juveniles who they come across in terms of street-level prostitution, but asking the next question, why are you out here, how are you out here, those sorts of things. It takes the right officer on the right day with the right young woman asking the right question to be able to discover a trafficking case. The folks that are calling your offices and complaining are dealing with street-level prostitution. It would have been easy for the officers to show up, clean up the problem, throw the young person in jail, and move on. But that's dealing, again, with the symptom and not the disease. And I think we've seen a change here recently. These young women often have a mistrust of the police that has been enforced by their pimps, has been beaten into them by their pimps. You're not to talk to the police. You're not to trust law enforcement. It often takes multiple contacts by law enforcement to be in a position to ultimately prosecute and hold accountable one of the pimps. We also, akin to domestic violence cases, have discovered, obviously, that there is a psychological pull, oftentimes, between the victims in these cases and their abusers, a reluctance on their part to testify. As the lieutenant just talked about, probably from my perspective, we have all the tools for prosecution. We are real good at dealing with the last pimp. Where the criminal justice system fails, I think, to some extent, is dealing with the next pimp. Because oftentimes we don't equip our victims from the criminal justice perspective with the ability to avoid the circumstances that put them in a position to be victimized. And my greatest concern from the prosecution perspective is knowing where my young victim is going to be for the next 4 to 6 months while my criminal case is alive. Because unlike a dope case or a bank robbery case or some other type of thing where I can lock up my evidence and keep it in evidence room to steal a line from Doug Justice, these young women I can't do that with. And we're in a circumstances where during that 4 to 6 months, their mental health, their drug addictions, their family background, socioeconomic backgrounds, all pulling them in different directions, most of the time away from cooperation with criminal prosecution. I am in strong support of what has been discussed here in terms of a facility that would provide stability, housing, mental health help, medical support, those sorts of things. A byproduct of that, of course, is availability to a criminal prosecution and holding pimps accountable for their criminal behavior. But I think a secondary product of that as well is equipping these young women with support and tools to avoid victimization in the future.
Thank you.
So one of the first briefings I got when I became police commissioner was on this issue, and you described some of the challenges of how this kind of crime is sort of conducted, and that the internet has contributed mightily to the challenges to enforce the laws. If you could just talk a little bit about and try to raise the awareness among Portlanders about some of the more modern day challenges of this issue and how it's difficult to find, make a case because of the internet.
Sure. One of the ways that the girls, when they're brought into town, are advertised, if you will, is on various internet sites. I have some investigators here that part of their daily job is to try to locate these girls through their postings on the internet. When we find a juvenile female that's posted on the internet, we could start doing some computer forensics to locate their pimp and try to arrest the pimp that way. You know, the internet's on one hand is a good thing, and on the other hand, it's a bad thing because there are no boundaries. Very hard to catch individuals that way. But then again, we use our federal partners and resources to kind of reach out to different states to try to track these phone numbers and the pimps down. It's very difficult. It's almost like trying to hit a moving target. It seems like we're almost always a step behind. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Where we used to have young women on 82nd Avenue, where we'd have a member of the public rolling through and saying, that just doesn't look right in terms of her age, the time, the method of dress, might generate a call to law enforcement, might have an officer on duty respond to that location and speak with them. Might be that right day, right question, right officer, right mood to get the response from her to open up a criminal case. But where we're talking about secreting them effectively, secreting them into a motel room, where the only interaction with the public is through an anonymous website, we're never going to have the call that's going to put the right person in with the right question in the right doorway to ask the right question. And that's the difficulty in terms of pulling those things out of a public view We don't get the friction with the public. We don't get a call to the law enforcement, and oftentimes we don't become aware of a potential criminal case.
So as a border city, I mean, 7 miles to our north is a whole different state. To what degree is that a challenge, that we're right on the border with the state of Washington? And are they involved? I look at the list of representatives from the various organizations, and I don't know all the acronyms, but to what degree is Clark County, state of Washington, part of this coalition?
Actually, I spoke a little bit earlier with a memorandum of understanding we're trying to get with the local FBI office. Speaking just yesterday, Vancouver Police, they're also working with the same local. It's interesting because when you cross over the state lines, you usually answer to the Seattle FBI office. They've worked that out. So that is good that Vancouver and Portland can be on that same task force. We have a same shared database for resources that way. So it's not an insurmountable problem. Our federal partners, once we do have the state line issue, we can go through Greg's office to see if there's a federal nexus and then raise it to the federal level that's appropriate. So it's a problem, but not really a procedural difference, whether it's 7 miles to the north or a couple hundred miles to the south down in California.
But we got room for improvement there that we can make on a relatively short timeline, because it's about jurisdiction and bureaucracy. And
yes.
No question.
Great. Thanks.
Lieutenant Marshall, how long has it been since your officers have identified a young prostitute that may be part of a trafficking scheme that you've then responded out with detectives from the sexual
How long has it been?
Unit? Yeah.
Like our last call out?
How long ago did you start doing that, where you would have somebody, a detective, respond out to then question of woman?
Well, briefly, Sergeant Justice is here. About a year and a half ago, the Drugs and Vice Division, the Vice Unit, was in the drug unit. Before my time going to the Detective Division, it was thought best to actually move the Vice detail to the Detective Division and combine efforts of Vice and sex crimes. Our Vice unit, for lack of better terms, we're kind of having the street officers do the street-level Vice prostitution issue. And Sergeant Justice and his detail kind of raise it up to the human trafficking. That move happened about a year and a half ago. And with the two, he only has two officers under his command. We're trying to use our resources as efficiently as we can. But there's more call outs than we can frankly respond to. So
I'm just curious, because it did seem like it was a fairly new program. I didn't remember hearing about that when we were first dealing with this out on 82nd 2 years ago. Have you been able to measure productivity or success with that kind of a response over what used to happen?
Very hard to measure. Some estimates that I've heard, Miriam said there's about 105 girls in their database. Other groups I've heard anywhere from 300 to 600. We're currently working at the state level to get more of a database just to track services for these women and girls, if nothing else. Recently, though, in the past couple of weeks, we've had success by rescuing three girls that were trafficked in multiple states through the internet and some tips we got through some advocacy groups. So I think our success rate anecdotally is getting better because more coordinated efforts. But that's three in a couple of weeks out of potentially 300 to 600. So again, I agree with the mayor, huge room potential for improvement.
So finally, what's the state of 82nd today compared to 2 years ago?
Comes and goes. I can't give you a hard specific number in my view, but I don't really speak out of turn because I don't frequent that myself personally to see with my eyes how it looks. I personally don't think it has changed much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you both.
Appreciate
you.
It.
Following up on Mayor Adams's questions, is somebody going to talk about the change in law in Washington? Can I ask you about that? There was recently a change in the law in Washington to make the penalties much more severe for the users and to essentially say that since this is statutory rape, that there is no crime for the person under 18. Do you know, can you tell me some more about that? And are we going to do something like that in Oregon?
Actually, Commissioner, you and I were at a meeting a couple of weeks ago where Shared Hope International presented the Senate bill, I can't remember the name, in Washington State, and it had compared and contrast Washington with Oregon. Personally, I haven't been able to find anybody who would be opposed to a similar legislative change for Oregon to match penalties. I've heard that Senator Wyden and Commissioner McKeel are already looking into efforts to raise legislation in the state of Oregon that would be similar to that in Oregon, or excuse me, in Washington State. I think it would be a great idea.
The most significant thing that that legislation did was it eliminated the requirement that the state prove knowledge as to the victim's age when an act of prostitution was included. Currently in Oregon, when somebody's between 16 and 18 years of age, the burden is on me as the prosecutor to prove that the person who purchased sex from them knew that fact, which of course is almost impossible to prove unless there's a specific discussion between them. And in Washington State, they eliminated that. One other thing that's been bandied about, at least in the Oregon legislature 2 years ago during the last session, was the potential in bifurcating the prostitution statutes to punish those who offer or agree to pay, as opposed to those who offer to receive money in exchange for prostitution, to treat those differently in terms of potential punishments.
So as Jerry Williams said, that's something that we'll discuss in our August meeting, and I'm glad to hear that you're interested in
some of these concepts I've put into our proposed city legislative priorities for Salem.
Great. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank
for your
you.
Work. So our last invited panelist is Jocelyn Baker, and she heads up the Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Task Force, which is sort of the umbrella under which all of these people have been meeting to work on solutions. So Jocelyn, if you could just, and it's being funded by a federal grant, so if you could just briefly explain the effort, and I think you have the task force members in front of you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners, and I'm happy to go last in the lineup of my community partners, and I had given you some materials that you have before you. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is this timeline of accomplishments, and people had alluded to the work that's been going on, and really in Multnomah County since 2005, there's been some pretty concrete, measurable efforts to address this issue. The timeline, you can look through it at your leisure, but it demonstrates the work that people have done that got us to this critical mass that people already talked about when they were testifying this afternoon, that made it possible for us to be in a really prime position, Multnomah County, to compete for and be awarded a $500,000 grant from the Office on Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is a federal office. We were one of three sites within the country to receive those funds, so it was highly competitive. And I think all the good work that you heard about today is why we were awarded that grant. I think some of the things that make us so vulnerable to this issue, we also have things that make us really well positioned to respond to this issue and to end the commercial sexual exploitation of children. We have a long history of collaboration in this community, and it's exciting to have the city and the county working together on this issue and joining with community partners and communities of faith and nonprofit community agencies to really look at ending this issue. So the task of this grant is to really bring people together. So I think that Lieutenant Marshman was talking about this idea of bringing people together. It's a Multnomah County grant, so our mission is to really look at Multnomah County and how we can bring the different partners together to better serve victims and to hold offenders accountable. Right from the get-go, we knew that it was short-sighted to only look into Multnomah County. We've partnered with Seattle, and we've partnered with Clark County, so that question came up earlier. We definitely have involved them. They all, you know, we all are struggling with this issue and coming up with solutions and coming up with challenges, and the more that we can work together right from the beginning of the effort, I think the better our success will be. You also have, so the LPSC, the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, designated the steering committee that works on commercial sexual exploitation of children as a committee. And so the steering committee really is looking at how do we bring, you know, how do we connect all these dots? How do we bring all these people together to have productive conversations about how we impact victim services and how we hold offenders accountable? To do that, then what we've done is designated eight different work groups, one of which is legislation with Commissioner Fritz, you were asking about. Commissioner McKeel's office, Corey Wyron, is leading that effort. So we've tried to bring all the people that are working on legislation together to try to develop a Safe Harbor Act. The one in Washington is one of the strongest ones in the country, so it sets a really good example. And Shared Hope is on our steering committee, and it's a really good partner and brings a wealth of information to that process. And that's just one example of kind of people coming together on ideas and really trying to come up with solutions of things that work. Another thing that people talked a lot about and is really always pretty central in our conversations is this issue of that people called it girls who run away when that they run back to the life. And I think that language in this issue is really important because it does look like they run away, but I think what they know in that exploitation environment is they know torture, they know violence, they know sexual assault, and that's delivered consistently. The pimps have a plan of how they run their businesses, and right now we don't have a very solid plan of how we're intervening. So yes, they run away, but we need to be able to give them better options. We need that whatever door they come in, whether it be a police officer, whether it be SARC, whether it be the hospital, that they are received as victims, that they understand. They don't need to understand our org charts or our bureaucracies, but they understand that, oh, everyone that talks to me gets that I'm a victim. They understand my exploitation. They understand what happened to me as a child that led me to be vulnerable to this exploitation, and they're here to help me. They don't need to understand our steering committee or how we all operate, but that will resonate with victims the better that we do to put that into place. We are doing a host of community training. We were fortunate to have GEMS come from New York City, which is they are a lead survivor-led organization that came in and trained staff and community partners and police officers. It was just a really dynamic training of 50 people that now are committed to getting training out to the community. So we'll be doing that. We're working on community engagement and public awareness and really any issue that the steering committee identifies or that somebody brings to us that they think we need to be addressing so that we don't miss something in this response is what we're trying to do. At the end of this three-year grant, we'll be successful if we have a coordinated community response to this issue, where professionals know where to plug in, survivors understand where they're a piece of that and how the services are delivered to them, and offenders are held accountable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a, if I could ask a question, is there a work plan developed?
Just about.
And when will that be done?
I would say probably fall. The work groups are, they have various topics. So like victim services is a huge work group, and they will all develop action plans that will then go up to the steering committee and create one comprehensive action plan, and the steering committee will make sure that that addresses all the areas. So the work groups have met twice now. Some of them got through in one meeting. So some of them do have work plans in place, but other ones are bigger issues. The victim service issues, one thing I want to say about housing, what we're really looking at is the feeling with these youth is there's nowhere to put them. Well, there are lots of places to put them. There's, you know, from the continuum of living with your family with supports to very secure locked facilities. We have those in our partnership with child welfare. We very much see these kids as dependency kids, not delinquency kids. And so, you know, staying on that, viewing them as a victim, understanding their trauma and exploitation. So what we need to do is figure out within that continuum of care, of residential care, what training, what programs, what changes to policies do we need to make to get those providers to be able to step up and work with these youth. Not every single provider, but the providers that really have that special drive and are willing to take on these youth.
And given the federal funding, is there anything that prevents us from working with north of the river, state of Washington, Clark County?
Nothing other than our drive to do so. No, there's nothing.
Real interested in including that.
Yeah, Seattle came down for our GEMS training. We specially invited them. We've had a really strong reciprocal relationship with the efforts there through City of Seattle with Terry Kimball and the Seattle PD, so we've had some good connection. We're trying to get our, they're doing a internet crimes against children training up there that's specifically for Seattle that GEMS is coming to Seattle to do. We've asked and been accepted to have officers and detectives go up and attend that training. So we have a good reciprocal relationship around training and around best practices happening. We'll be going up, Commissioner McKeel, Corey Wyburn and myself will go up in August. They're going to have a one-day stakeholder meeting, and we're going to join in that so that we can learn from each other. We've been really, that is the best way to go for us. Additionally, I met with Christine Herman and have talked to some folks in her office, the Sex Assault Task Force office, about the idea of having an Oregon summit on this issue. So that's just in the starting phases, but really looking at bringing everyone that's working on this issue in Oregon together to talk about where we need to go next. That will definitely include Washington State, because one of the committees on our work groups is an interstate collaboration committee. So I think we'll probably start with the summit and then go into some regional meetings.
Great. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that completes our invited testimony, but I believe there are people signed up for public testimony.
We have six people signed up.
Okay.
The first three, please come on up, are Doug, Megan, and Christy.
If I may, here's those. Let's start your thing.
Oh, great.
Thank you. Welcome. You want to start, Doug?
Sure, I'll start.
Okay.
I'm Sergeant Doug Justice, Portland Police. Now full-time vice sergeant again, and that's Detective Megan Burkeen, and this is our hero. She was forced into prostitution at 16, and with Megan's help, she was able to get away, and then he tried to kill her. So I brought her here today because I think you guys need to listen to how important this is for us as adults, us as leaders, to take this serious. And so I'd just like her to say a few words to you guys about what it meant to have Megan able to help her.
First off, I just want to let you guys, I want to inform you guys that this doesn't just happen to people that are in foster care or people that have divorced parents. My parents have been married for 25 years, and this happened to me. I was just a normal kid. I graduated high school. You know, I wasn't a bad kid, and it happened to me because I was vulnerable. It was really... I would have to say, they say that I'm a hero, but Megan and Doug, the police officers that stopped me when I was walking on 82nd, they're all heroes to me because they didn't give up on me. And I want to let you guys know that it's really important for all the police officers out there to give their card every time they see a girl and they know that they're doing that, give them your card. Even if you think they might throw it away, give it to them. We have a lot of trees in the state. You know, we can make a lot of cards. So give them away every time you see that. Because I kept every single one of those cards. I never called, but I kept them. And I told my mom, I let my mom, gave her clues about where I was staying. And then that's when she got a hold of Megan. And Megan checked up on me all the time. And they let me know that I was a victim because I was scared, you know. I didn't trust the police because I was brainwashed, and I want to let everybody know the police are not out here to hurt you. They're out here to help you, and that's what their job is for. So the girls need to know that. They need to know that they shouldn't run away because I'm still here. And this was 3 years ago that it happened to me, you know, two or three years ago that it happened to me, and I'm still here. He tried to kill me. You know, girls think that, you know, if they have to testify, they're going to die, they're going to be killed. I was fortunate that I didn't have to testify because they had the 911 call from that, and he pled guilty. He's now serving 8 years for promoting, compelling, and assault, too. They just need to know. Police officers are here to help us, you know. Sorry, I'm kind of nervous.
Thank you.
You're doing great.
Yeah, you're doing great. Christy?
And I think we need more. Actually, I know we need more police officers like Megan to help because, what, there's two? There's two of them. And how many girls is there that are victims right now? Bunches. Yeah, I can't even count on... You know, hands and feet, how many girls are out there that, you know. And like I said, it could be anybody, not just somebody that's been in, you know, that's been assaulted. I was never assaulted sexually when I was a child. I was never abused. My parents never beat me. You know, I have good friends. It's just, you know, I got mixed up with the wrong crowd, and that's how it happened.
We appreciate, is it Christy?
Yeah.
And we appreciate, Christy, you being here today and
thank you.
Sharing your story with us. So thank you.
very impressive. You did a great job.
Thanks. I'm really nervous.
Dr. Burkoon, did you want to add anything?
I'm just up here to support Christy, so thank you.
And they're heroes.
Yes,
they are. For the record,
they are
police officers are heroes.
Yes. Christy, what do you want to do moving on?
For my life personally, I was going to college. I wanted to be a crime scene investigator.